This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. I'm Mike McCurdy. It's Sound Ideas. The Me Too movement might be missing the bulk of workplace harassment against women. The National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine has released a report on sexual harassment of women in academia. Mary Cullen has the Central Illinois connection to this story.
The Academy's report, titled Sexual Harassment of Women, Climate, Culture, and Consequences in Academic Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, took over 2 years and was completed by a committee of more than 20 experts. One of those experts is Illinois State University Distinguished Professor of Psychology, John Pryor. Pryor says the report puts sexual harassment into a broader context, reaching beyond the typical stories that we see coming out of the Me Too movement.
People who studied sexual harassment, as I have for more than 30 years, know that sexual harassment is something that has been pervasive in the experiences of working women as well as women in academic context. So it's nothing new to researchers to think that there are many women who've experienced sexual harassment.
The study addresses three forms of sexual harassment: gender harassment, unwanted sexual attention, and sexual coercion. Can you explain these?
Using scientific sampling methods, and we have found that the kind of thing that happens most commonly to women with regard to sexual harassment is this first thing you mentioned, gender harassment. One of the things important to understand about gender harassment is that it's something that is different from some of these experiences that are described by women in the Me Too movement and some very high-profile kinds of cases that are very prominent in the media. Essentially, gender harassment is sexist behavior. It's a put-down of women. It involves sexist hostility, like saying that women don't belong in a particular field or profession, or that they somehow are inferior to men, or ostracizing women in some sort of way. It can also involve crude behavior, making crude jokes or crude comments about people with regard to their appearance. Another thing important to point out is that these are not really sexual behaviors. They're sexist behaviors. There are other forms of sexual harassment, unwanted sexual attention, and sexual coercion that are sexual behaviors. Unwanted sexual attention, an example of that would be repeated requests for a date and being turned down each time and continuing to do it. And sexual coercion is something that is something involves some sort of power that someone has over someone. So it would, for example, involve some sort of threat or potential bribe to try to get somebody to be sexually cooperative. So these are sexual kinds of behaviors. But what you see is that they're much less common than gender harassment. So the garden variety is something that's gender harassment.
And one way that we're seeing institutions, not only universities, but organizations across the board combat this issue is implementing training sessions in order to educate their employees on how to properly handle or prevent sexual harassment in the workplace. What are we seeing with these trainings? And based on the report that you just completed, do we have any takeaways on how we can educate ourselves other than trainings?
Training is something that means different things for different institutions. Sometimes it's something that has more of an educational focus to tell people, well, what is sexual harassment? What do you do about it if you think you've been sexually harassed or you report to? Those kinds of things are important kinds of things for people to know. When we look at the evidence from the research literature with regard to the effectiveness of training in reducing sexual harassment, what we see is something that's pretty dismal. And there's really not evidence that suggests that training is having some sort of impact on sexual harassment. Now, one of the ironic kinds of reasons why this is so, and this is something that's borne out in our report, is that training is something that has this sort of legal sort of angle to it. If you are an institution and you have been sued for sexual harassment by one of your employees, or if an academic institution, one of your students, one of the things that you can point to is an affirmative defense that you've taken steps to try to do something about sexual harassment, something that's really protective of you in a lawsuit, is to say that you've had training. But oddly enough, one of the things that you don't have to prove is that the training did anything or made any difference with regard to the people who participated. And we know that training actually sometimes can have a negative effect on people who go through it. There's kind of a backlash. That's particularly when people who go through the training can see, and sometimes it's very obvious, that the training is something that really doesn't make a lot of sense. They don't think it is something that has any impact on people. So there's actually sometimes a backlash. One of the things as I said, is not required of people for this to be an affirmative defense, is to prove that the training did anything. This is something that has had this really negative effect, not only on academic institutions, but on businesses as well. They don't want to evaluate the training that is being done, because if they have some training and they evaluate it and they find, oh, it didn't do anything, then they are legally culpable again because they've done some sort of ineffective kind of training. So you see the idea of evaluations of training that's kind of focused on the training are periodic sorts of surveys that might tell you whether or not sexual harassment's going up or going down. Those are things that institutions are basically discouraged from doing because of the idea that showing merely that you did training is an affirmative defense.
Now, kind of going back to what you had mentioned in your response there, you mentioned how the report found that relying solely on the legal system is not enough to prevent the sexual harassment, and that institutions have to focus on the culture and the climate within their own organization. So I know in the report it does mention there's a couple findings about medical students in particular. Can we kind of talk about the culture within that and the results that the study did find there?
Yes. One of the goals of this report was to examine sexual harassment as potentially an obstacle for women's participation and achievement in the fields of science, engineering, and medicine. And one of the things that we did in this report is we commissioned a study that involved a very large data set of people who were surveyed from the University of Texas system, and they surveyed the students looking at their experiences of sexual harassment using evidence-based measures, using measures that have been proven to have some sort of scientific validity. And one of the very interesting findings here is we start to compare students from medical school, engineering schools, science programs, and non-STEM people, non-STEM majors. We see some very big differences. 47% of women who were surveyed from medical schools said that they'd experienced sexual harassment from faculty in those medical schools. So there's some big problems in medical school. One of the puzzling things about what you see with women in medical school is there actually are increasing numbers of women in medical school, but apparently not so much when you look at the faculty who teach in medical schools, but there are increasing numbers of women who are students in medical schools. Perhaps a critique that some people might make about this finding to say that, well, medical school is a pretty rough kind of environment for everybody. Everybody gets harassed. So if you see this spike in women, it's probably just something that relates to medical school being kind of a rough environment where a lot of harassment takes place of all sorts. But if we look at men's answers to these same questions that women were asked, we see that roughly half as many men who are medical students experienced the kinds of sexually harassing behaviors that women experienced in medical school. So it's something happening here that seems to be gendered. So it's harassment that has to do with someone's gender or sex.
So kind of building off of that gendered issue, according to the study, the two characteristics of environments that indicate a higher sexual harassment level would be a male-dominated field as well as an organizational climate that communicates a tolerance of that type of behavior. Can you kind of speak to those two?
Yeah, these are factors that have been studied across a variety of different settings. So we can point to research that's been done in academic settings, as well as a great deal of research that's been done in work settings and also the military. So those two factors that you mentioned, so the ratio of men to women, and it's really what's important is the ratio where you actually work, so your actual work group. And a tolerance of this kind of behavior is something that we've known for a long time is a factor with regard to whether or not sexual harassment is going to occur. You also see that the leadership of a particular work group, if it's a male, you're more likely to see sexual harassment than if it's a female who's the leader of the work group. And another thing that research has found is that if a line of work is something that has been traditionally considered to be a masculine domain, something that males typically do, you're going to see higher levels of sexual harassment. There are a lot of examples of this looking at studies in work settings.
And kind of going with that organizational climate, communicating a tolerance of the behavior, we're seeing a lot of victims are reluctant to report their harassment based on thinking that either reporting is either risky or discouraged. Can you kind of speak to that and why we're seeing a lack of reporting?
Well, reporting is a complex sort of behavior. And there are different ways to think about reporting, but here's one framework that's something that is useful. Sexual harassment is something, when it happens to you, is something that is a form of stress. And when people experience stress of any sort, they try different ways of coping with that stress. If you look at reporting, making a formal report, filing a complaint, that kind of thing, as a means of coping sexual harassment. It's, one of the things that it highlights is the idea that there are other things that you do with regard to coping with sexual harassment. And usually you try those other things first, because reporting is something that has some downside with regard to your fear of retaliation or maybe other sorts of factors as well. But it's kind of a more extreme kind of thing. Typically, when you look at reasons that people don't report, they have a variety of different kinds of reasons that they didn't report. And they often say that they tried other kinds of things. One of the more common things that people try is you try to avoid the harasser. If you're in some sort of academic setting where there's someone who is a harasser, you might try to remove yourself from that. So maybe if it's a professor, you might drop the class, or you make sure that you're not alone with that person if there's some sort of sense of which the person is coming on to you in some way. But there are a variety of different things that people do that fit into this sort of category of avoiding the harasser. Some of these things have very detrimental effects on women's career choices. So if somebody who is the most talented professor in whatever your field is at your university is someone who's a harasser, someone who treats women in some sexist sort of way, you might avoid that person's class. You might be missing something with regard to the academic end of things. You're avoiding the harassment, but you're missing something that might be a valuable part of your education because you have to do that.
Going with that, that doesn't affect only the individual. That can affect the whole field further down the line. If you're not getting the best education that you possibly could out of fear for sexual harassment or being placed in an uncomfortable environment, that's not only going to impact the individual. That could reach out past that.
That's right. And as I said, the focus of this report was on trying to understand sexual harassment as an obstacle or barrier for women's achievement in science, engineering, medicine. You can look at other kinds of things that are connected to that besides just dropping out. One of the things that is a consequence of experiencing gender harassment, which is kind of a put-down, is an undermining of a woman's confidence. So if your professor makes disparaging remarks about women, then it's something that can undermine your confidence.
So I know the report recommends implementing committee-based advising and mentoring networks. How can we see these types of preventative measures implemented in the real world?
If you look at in science fields, what you see is a very hierarchical kind of structure. If that person is a sexual harasser, then there's very little that you could do about it without hurting your career.
ISU Professor John Pryor helped author a new national report on sexual harassment in the sciences and academia. He spoke with GLT's Mary Cullen. Pryor says to prevent one person from having too much power, he suggests using committee structures instead. It's Sound Ideas on GLT.